So the next section, this is from the Gathas on moral culture. Training the ego, or training of the ego, vanity. Man has the desire to do good and to refrain from doing evil, because to do so feeds his vanity. So really interesting. Is anyone thinking about that? I mean, that's like, say what? You know what I mean? Doesn't it make you ask, like, what is he talking about? Man has the desire to do good and to refrain from doing evil, because to do so feeds his vanity. What a peculiar statement. Are you curious for more? Among 1,000 good and virtuous people, there is scarcely one who does good. Among 1,000 good and virtuous people, there is scarcely one who does good. Now, who's heard the phrase, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions"? It highlights that. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. So again, among 1,000 good and virtuous people, there is scarcely one who does good and refrains from evil, because that is his natural inclination. The majority of those engaged in art, science, religion, or politics are conscious all the time of the opinion of others, and they can only work upon the lines they are following if appreciation comes from some quarter. The least antagonism or opposition discourages them and often kills their desire. Among thousands, there is one great soul that can keep firm and strong in his purpose through life. Unshaken and unweakened by opposition from any side, it is that person who wins in the end and accomplishes things that are worthwhile. Now, to highlight that, let me just say a few names. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama. More than a billion people, we could say, live in a political atmosphere that's absolutely contrary to the ideals of His Holiness and the Tibetan Buddhist teachings. Has he lost faith or hope? And what about Mother Teresa? My God, you would have thought she was the lowest person on earth. She begged, she beseeched, she wrote letters, she pleaded, she bargained, and again she was refused to have even one little room given to her as support in Calcutta to start her great work, which now has helped so many people. What about Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi? Whole country, his own country, often against him, not to mention the great empire of England. And look what he accomplished. Independence for a nation. These people are not looking for acceptance and approval. They are living from a truth with such courage that moves them forward, even in the face of great opposition. This is the essence of this teaching. I find these examples, and I always find it a great consolation that in art, the really great beings that were highlights throughout art history were the ones that departed from the conventional, from the traditional. They changed things. People thought they were crazy, mad people, whatever. They did not detour from their creative impulse, and they changed the course of history. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of purification practices and clarity. To eliminate self-doubt without falling into a mania that you're, everything one does is correct. It's good to keep a question, to keep objective, to have good counsel, as all of these beings do. They have good and wise counsel also. People they trust that can offer a reflection, but that person also must be very clear. Or else it becomes the play of that person's ego too. Back to the reading and the teaching of Hazrat Anayat Khan. In the lives of all the great souls who have accomplished wonderful deeds in life, you will surely find this hidden mystery. Those souls who have it have not learned it. It happened to be their nature. And the thinker will see in this a philosophy which teaches that it is the ego that chains man's feet, keeping him from progress in all paths in life. The ego not only makes man self-conscious, but it makes him a coward and renders him helpless. He is timid because he sees his own limitations, and he is helpless because everything stronger overpowers him as he confines his being within a certain limit. Shall I read that again? In the lives of the great souls who have accomplished wonderful deeds in life, you will surely see this mystery hidden. Again, the idea that this sort of a paradoxical statement that good and virtuous people often, the intentions aren't there. But then you have these other souls that have been catalytic, transformative beings that have this hidden mystery, that sometimes it means defying convention, absolutely contradicting status quo in order to accomplish something greater. Okay. So then he says, in the lives of the great souls who have accomplished wonderful deeds in life, you will surely find this mystery hidden. Those souls have not learned it. It happens to be their nature. Here he's implying perhaps it's a karmic or dharmic. They didn't learn it. Someone doesn't teach us this. We teach ourselves this, I would say. You can see the difference. Children raised in the same, they have the same biology, and they have the same environmental circumstances, are entirely different in temperament or in the way that they live their lives. These souls have not learned it. It happens to be their nature. And the thinker will see in this a philosophy which teaches that it is the ego that chains man's feet, keeping him from progress in all paths in life. The ego not only makes man self-conscious, but it makes of him a coward and renders him helpless. He is timid because he sees his own limitations. And he is helpless because everything stronger overpowers him as he confines his being within a certain limit. Let me tell you, friends, anytime you go against what a group doesn't want to do, or a person doesn't want to do, or society doesn't want you to do, or a country doesn't want you to do, you're going to be considered a revolutionary. And you know what sometimes happens? Jesus, they hung on the cross. Many other people had to leave their homeland for safety. Some people have been able to do that. For example, Gandhi was able to do it. It's not impossible, but it takes great courage and strength. And people will often offer a reflection that you're inappropriate, that you're crazy, that you speak out of turn, etc., etc., all in the effort to control you or the situation. We see this often in the workplace.
What happens when you speak up and call them nasty people? And this is obviously not God's. Our commandment is love one another. Does that help?
I think that if one can maintain that attitude while taking up one's action, that's the best way. Mm-hmm. One may even be called forth to say something that is harsh, but if done with the attitude of not coming from one's personal will, I think things can shift.
But the nasty people still don't get it. They're so thick. Mm-hmm.
Oh, honey, we all know that. We'll be getting to that in a few moments. We know that. And you know what? That's the face, and those are the actions, and those are the words of ignorance.
Of who?
Ignorance.
Oh, yes.
And in a way, it's an interesting thing. In Holland this year at the Universal Worship, I gave the talk, and I think it'll be available online, Towards a Greater Understanding. And I talk about this. But here's the deal. I really do believe that in each person there is the divine spark. But it is also up to that person to kindle that spark and to bring forth their light. The personality and the soul, in Buddhism we would say the personality and consciousness, are not the same. So when you say these people, we all know those people. We are those people too. Believe me, other people think we're
that. Think we are, but we're not.
You know. But the thing is that we all have things that trigger other people. That's just part of human nature. And the thing is that
divine our positivity
could be,
and they don't like being unconventional and telling the truth. You know,
right?
Telling it how it is.
Right.
So my point is that, in truth, we can love everyone, but we don't have to like everyone. We don't have to like those aspects
And probably we have to be very careful who we know in the future so that our life is filled with loving, kind, compassion, and that we don't have any room for negativity.
Mm-hmm. Negativity will always be there, but this again is one of the great teachings of the breath, and of these teachings that we can, you know, it's just like in Tai Chi or in Karate. Chi, when that comes, you use the force of that. Do you see what I'm saying? You don't stand up to it or resist it.
Always
you use the force coming. So that's a vast discussion, but may we get back here? We can talk about it afterwards. Yes.
Could you clarify workplace?
Workplace is where we work, where we do our jobs.
Here in Petra, who had asked.
Yeah.
So I think it's just English.
But we don't have to go very far. We can find that when we go shopping or on a bus or in traffic, or it's there. It's also there. Okay. So I'll go back a few sentences. The ego not only makes man self-conscious, but it makes him a coward and renders him helpless. He is timid because he sees his own limitations, and he is helpless because everything stronger overpowers him as he confines his own being within a certain limit. Besides all the other disadvantages that self-consciousness brings with it, there is about all else one thing it does. It prevents man from realizing that the thought of self keeps him away from God. In the heart of man, there is room for one only, either himself or for God. Besides all the other disadvantage that self-consciousness brings with it, there is about all else one thing it does. It prevents man from realizing that the thought of self keeps him away from God. In the heart of man, there is room for only one, either for himself, herself, or for God. I will be sharing other things that I think highlight this teaching of Hazrat Anayat Khan's from different aspects, gives different perspectives. But as a way of transitioning, there is a beautiful phrase. You know, Hazrat Anayat Khan gave these English phrases to his students, and they were kept in his personal notebook. There are hundreds of them, really. They're beautiful. And some of them, some of you have received as practices. But here's one that I think very much relates to this teaching. And I thought that we might do this practice just concentrating on the vibration of the words while focusing on the breath. So let me read the phrase a few times, and then we can breathe in while concentrating on part of this phrase and breathe out while concentrating on the other aspect of the phrase. Give me new spirit of enthusiasm and courage to proceed on life's path. Give me new spirit of enthusiasm and courage to proceed on life's path. Give me new spirit of enthusiasm and courage to proceed on life's path. So breathe in the phrase. Give me new spirit of enthusiasm and courage, and breathe out, to proceed on life's path. In, give me new spirit of enthusiasm and courage, and out, to proceed on life's path. In, give me new spirit of enthusiasm and courage, and out to proceed on life's path. Just continue. beautiful thing, a kind of invocation, a prayer, to ask for this new spirit to be infused with a new spirit of enthusiasm and courage. We don't have to be a Dalai Lama. We don't have to be a Mother Teresa. We don't have to be a Gandhi. But this is our life. And to have enthusiasm and courage to make it the best life possible, to be a hero in our own right, in our own life, to proceed on life's path, to have courage, to have enthusiasm, even in the face of limitations, whatever they may be. And certainly we all have them. We are a human being. But that's what makes us beautiful also. I would like to read the words of the prayer Nabi by Hazrat Inayat Khan. This is the prayer that is said. It's one of the secondary prayers that's said at midday. And it's beautiful because it offers some insight that great illuminated beings also understand these calls of our own heart, of our own mind, of our own limitation, of the need to have objects of reliance, to have something on which we rely on. And again, this prayer is titled Nabi. The word means prophet. A torch in the darkness. A staff during my weakness. A rock in the weariness of life. Thou, my master, maketh earth a paradise. Thy thought giveth me unearthly joy. Thy light illuminateth my life's path. Thy words inspire me with divine wisdom. I follow in thy footsteps, which lead me closer to the eternal goal. Comforter of the brokenhearted, support of those in need, friend of the lovers of truth, blessed Master, thou art the prophet of. I mean, who amongst us doesn't need a torch in our own darkness, or a staff during our weakness, or a rock when we grow weary? And here is the promise that the Master, our Master, Prophet, our great illuminated being that offers us wisdom and inspiration can make earth a paradise. That their thoughts can give us an unearthly joy. That their light can illuminate our life's path. And that we can be inspired with divine wisdom through the words. Comforter of the brokenhearted. Who amongst us hasn't had our heart broken? Support of those in need. Who amongst us doesn't have a need? Friend of the lovers of truth. Always we're seeking the truth in life, the truth in circumstances, the truth of our own being. Blessed Master, Thou art the prophet of God. I've said it many times, these prayers are rather complete in and of themselves. They can give us great enthusiasm and strength and courage. Are there any comments?
This is the mudra for courage.
That's a good mudra.
And it seems to me that when you do shine the light on all the evil, they're out of their souls and they have a prayer, they have to go flee. Don't we wish?
Just keep shining.
Yeah.
Anything else? Our Skype friends are still with us. You haven't fallen asleep over there now, have you? Okay. This is from the supplemental readings, and this is from the message papers, which are somewhat available, but not published in a book form. And these message papers are very insightful. They were, again, as almost everything else, oral teachings that Hazrat Inayat Khan gave. And this section deals with the great masters. And this is one of the masters that we invoke in the prayer Salat, Rama. And the story of Rama is given to us in the great epic work called the Mahabharata. And I really would like to take the time, if you have the patience, to talk about the other books, because they have one of just pithy little aspects of the Mahabharata, because they illuminate different aspects of the teachings and of our life. Do you have the patience to stick with me? Okay. So the Mahabharata, Bharata is a dynasty, was a dynasty. And so Maha means great. So this is the great tale of Bharata. So there are all these tales that came out of it. And they're beautiful moral teachings, spiritual teachings, religious teachings. And the Mahabharata contains both philosophical and devotional teachings. For example, there is a discussion of the four goals of life. The four goals being right action, purpose, pleasure, which could be considered in our passions, and liberation, which of course we're all seeking that in some ways. So the Mahabharata includes the Bhagavad Gita, which I'm sure all of you know, which is the story of Lord Krishna. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna has a conversation with his chariot driver, Arjuna. And he's talking to Arjuna because Arjuna has this great sort of moral dilemma. They're about to go into battle, and he will be confronted with fighting his own relatives, his cousins. And Lord Krishna explains to Arjuna that it's his duty as a warrior and as a prince, and he elaborates on various teachings from the Vedanta and examples and analogy, and says that he must take up this battle. So Krishna in this instance is talking about himself, that he's this prince, that he has this responsibility. And through this conversation, Arjuna comes to the realization that he's having a conversation with a supreme being. That again, we're not falling into this sentimentality. This is my cousin, therefore I cannot. It's metaphorical, you see. It's not going out and saying, go slay your cousin. It's saying, but maybe the cousins are representing something within ourselves that we need to confront and do battle with. You understand? Okay. It's a really beautiful story if you haven't read it, and I hope that you can get a good translation, because it's, again, allegorical, and it contains this kind of a guide to life on how to move through these different aspects of our being that need to, again, be clarified. And one could say purified, but not because they're necessarily dirtied or soiled in some way, but because they maybe have grown dusty or need to be clarified. That one of the other stories is in the Bhagavad Gita is the Dhammayata. This great story, because it ties, these all tie into the teaching actually. So Dhammayata, she's a Hindu goddess, and she has great beauty and great grace, and so much so that all the gods, they can't stop admiring her. And who does she fall in love with? She falls in love with Nala simply from hearing of his virtues and accomplishments from a golden swan. And of course we know about the swan. If you see swans, you know that they called them the ugly ducklings before they transform into these swans. And here's this golden swan that's been transformed that tells her about the about this being named Nala. And so there comes a time when Dhammayati is to choose her husband. And of course all the gods and the princes and the kings, they all come because they want to marry her. She's so beautiful. She's so graceful. And so there's this big, of course, festival, ball, you might say, and everyone is in attendance. And on their way, they meet Nala, all of these great beings. And they order him to be their messenger, to go ahead of them, and to inform Dhammayati that she must choose one of them to be her husband. So he's this more lowly person that they expect will carry this message and that she will listen, as he's just merely the messenger. But when she sees him, she agrees to pay her respects to the gods. She agrees that much. Like, I'll receive them, I'll pay that much respect. But she insists on choosing him for her husband. And the gods, then they each disguise themselves as Nala. And they present themselves. And they ask Dhammayata to choose amongst them. Like, they're all appearing magically as him. But Dhammayata, she sees through all of them, and she's aware of her true beloved one. And why? Because he's not a god. He's a human being. And because he cannot be perfect, he is set apart from the gods, and that's who she wants to make her life full and meaningful. It's a beautiful story. It's quite long. I'm giving you the cliff notes here. But it's a really beautiful story. And it's interesting because also in Buddhism, they also say that and Murshid says it also, the highest form of incarnation is as a human being, not as a god. That's highlighted here from the Hindu tradition in this story. So there's one more story. And it's about this boy. And he's born from a doe and a human being. And he has a horn in his forehead. Does that sound familiar? And his name is Rishashringa. It means horned rishi. Rishi, of course, is one that has gone off to do austere practices alone. So part of the reason that he's gone off is because he has his horn sticking out of his head, right? So he becomes a hermit, and he's brought up in the forest by his father, who's also a sage. His name is Vibhadaka. Vibhadaka. And of course his mother, as I said, was a deer or a doe. And this boy has never seen, because the mother leaves right away after giving birth, and these two are left in isolation, the father and the little boy with the horn in his head. And so he's gone all through his life without seeing another human being until he grows to his manhood. And at this point, there's this kingdom, and it's called Agna. And this kingdom has gone through this great drought and great famine. And the king, whose name is Ramapada, was advised by his Brahmins, priest, that the sage Rishashringa was the only person who could bring rain. So the king sent the most charming courtesans of the city, keeping in mind now he doesn't know any human beings, right? And entrust them with the mission of bringing Rishashringa back to Agna. And one of them succeeded in her attempt and brings him back to the kingdom. Well, and he saves the kingdom is the short story. Of course, this goes on. It's an epic tale. Well, in return, the king decides to give him his daughter, his daughter's hand in marriage. And let me go through here. Okay. So, this is the beautiful part of this story. So these great rains that were made by Rishashringa were the things that created the great river from which was born Ram. Very interesting how these all things, and I can't possibly, this is years of study, but these beautiful stories interweave and have these life stories. But part of the reason I'm saying this, because I want to, of course, interest you in the Mahabharata and the reading of these various texts, but also I'm trying to get to the story of Rama, because it highlights the story today on training the ego and on having courage. Is everybody still with me? I like storytelling. It always interests people. You'll think about it later and you'll realize, oh gosh, that had another meaning altogether, I hope. So, here's the story of Rama, and these are in the words of Hasrat Naikon. All that mishmash before was me, but this is a Naikon, and he's very clear. So he says, as a young prince, Rama had the education of spiritual and of ethical nature under the leadership of Vasishta, the great spiritual master of that time. So to begin with in his life, there was this great influence. And under the influence of Vasishta, Rama grew up to be an ideal young man. Then there was a ceremony arranged, because there was a demand from every side for Sita, the maiden whose hand was asked for by all the great Maharajas of that time. So a Raj is like a prince, and the Maharaj are like the great prince, Maha, great. And Rama went there. The story is that all the princesses, and all the Maharajas were dressed with jewels and in gorgeous dresses, except Rama. Because he came directly from Vasishta's school, which was in the forest, so he was living a country life, or a forest life, we could say. And with all this, Rama won Sita in the end, just like this little horned boy did. See? It was Rama who struck the right note in the heart of Sita. And all the Maharajas who were present were really against this because they wanted Sita. Are we good here? Then for 12 years, as Rama's father had taken a vow that Rama must go to the forest and live an ascetic life, a life of thought, before Rama could be entitled to rule his country, because his father was a king, Rama was sent away to do his practice. And Sita went with Rama into the forest. Ravana, who was the priest who was opposed to Rama's success as a bridegroom, followed Rama and Sita into the forest and seized the opportunity when it presented itself. Rama had gone to bring some fresh fruit and water, and there Sita was left alone. A great teaching here, too. Think about it. Sita could be said to represent the soul. And what happens when you leave the soul unattended? Well, what happens in the story is Ravana lifts up Sita against her wishes and flew away with her. And now there comes a test. The one test is for the prince, Rama, who's outside of his country, and the other test is to have lost all he had, and that is his bride. You understand the metaphor. When we're outside of ourselves, we can lose our soul. Or when we're looking externally, Rama was looking for fruit and food. You understand? Material food. The soul can become lost. Some great teaching stories. They're mere entertainment at one level, at another level. Great metaphorical teachings here. So, Ravana lifts Sita up against her wishes and flies away with her. And as I said, here is Rama. He's outside of his own country, and he's now lost his beloved Sita. But here Rama shows balance. Because instead of being discouraged, here's where the ego can serve. Can be vain, looking for approval from everywhere else, or the ego can be called into action as a servant. So here, he shows balance. Instead of being discouraged, he still trusts in her love, in his soul. You see? He trusts in his essence for him. And he still has trust in providence. Murshid uses this word providence a lot. This foreseen hand or guidance of God. He uses it frequently. So instead of being disappointed, again, instead of us finding discouragement, we say, oh, I have to get back on track. I have to realign, right? So instead of being disappointed, he went on searching for her. They search again, contact with the soul, with that divinity. And in the end, she was found. But she was a captive in the garden of the palace of Ravana. Now, if you know about Ravana, Ravana is the god or king that has all these different heads. And Alima and others, the different heads are things like, they're the seven deadly sins. Lust, greed, anger, so on and so forth. Gluttony. So this is how Ravana is. He appears in this way. And then it said that in order to free Sita, Ram accepts the help of Hanuman. And Hanuman, again, as we've said it sometimes in this class, is the monkey king. Again, the animal nature who can sometimes come to our aid when we need to accomplish something. Okay. So, Murshid says, this shows that in order to accomplish, or in order to wage a war against an earthly king, Rama had to seek an earthly help. This may be for Diane, who has her ears plugged. Sometimes you have to also seek an earthly help. Okay, but earthly help has also the divine spark, the divine power in it. So Rama has to seek an earthly help. He did not invite wise men to come and help him at that time. They could not have helped him. The wise men would have said, have courage, be wise, have patience, sit down, calm yourself, cool yourself, have sense, be reasonable. She is not there. It is impossible. You are not a ruling prince. You are in the forest. You are alone. You understand how this ties into the teaching of vanity? The wise would say that. But. Oh, and they would also say, the Prince Ravana has taken her away. She would have not gone if she had not been willing. So now they're getting him to doubt even this beautiful being, Sita. Every sort of reasoning clever people would have brought before him. Clever. It's not a compliment, believe me, especially in Eastern language, Eastern speak. Someone calls you clever, that's the biggest insult they can give you, and it's highlighted here. It's not good to be clever. Don't take it as a compliment if someone says that, especially if they're from the East. They think you're calculating and manipulative. That's what it means. Every sort of reasoning clever people would have brought to him. But the primitive people, the salt of the earth people, the real people, okay, they were ready to give their lives in order to serve that spiritual soul. And at the same time, this is interesting, it shows how primitive minds can feel the spiritual soul more easily. Primitive, in quotes, often an insult in our language. You're so primitive. You're uncivilized. Really? I choose that. Okay. At the same time, it shows how primitive minds can feel the spiritual soul more easily, more readily, than so-called clever men. They sympathize with the spiritual soul. No one else came except the wild people of the forest. This shows the wisdom of Rama also to control this people, because they're usually just sort of doing their own thing, right? And some of them were accustomed. You know, they weren't living in the way that we live collectively. So some of them would have the tendency when they want to go to the east or go to the south. Some walking, some jumping, some whatever. They were free. But to control the army of that kind of people, Murshid says, and then to make a success in the war with the king, this shows again Rama's balance. So one could also make the analogy, all these aspects of our being, these self-doubts, these primitive impulses, if we can rally them and bring them onto the spiritual path, how much more they can support us. You understand? Then as he had the confidence that Sita was for him, Sita was his bride, he fought and he took her back to his land. After this ordeal, after this trial, this is the value of those ordeals and trials in life, by the way. After this ordeal, after this trial, when Rama came back, he was able to rule his country in an ideal way. Therefore, balance is represented by the life of Rama, and all such things as courage, hope, confidence, trust, and all these come from balance. Again, Again, I want to say balance is like, isn't like a teeter-totter being parallel to the ground. Sometimes it's very active, and then it falls into a natural state. So in this instance, he had to rally the forces, the forest people, so to speak, his own will against perhaps the will of clever advisors to take this action, a very serious action, to enter the, to do battle with Ravana, this great demon with all these heads, to gain back his Sita, his soul, so that he could what? He could rule his country in an ideal way, rule himself in an ideal way. And that, from those trials, from those difficulties, like in our own life, if we can confront them and go through them, we gain courage, hope, confidence, trust. Comments? Questions?
I have one thing to say. There's a song that says, when you look around and everything seems gone and you don't know what to do, a hero comes along. Yeah. And that hero's inside of you.
Right.
It's beautiful. That's it. That
does it all. Anything else?